Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone.
Franchise Pros. Stand the
there
man.
We go. Technology. Pulse Stand. You gotta love
Badlands,
it.
Badlands, baby. Huh. Franchising today. Sustainable growth. The sensible franchising. Franchise today. Sustainable growth. The sensible franchise. Franchise today. Franchise today. Franchise today. Yeah.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. And, of course, I am broadcasting live from Houston, Texas, and my co-host, Stan Friedman, is in the city of Atlanta, which is under siege with storms right now. Stan, hope you're doing well and you're staying safe.
Hey, Paul. I am doing fine. It's just it looks like one week or the other, it's either you or me that gets pounded. But this is our week, and it does sound like a war zone earlier today, and it's about to start again. So hopefully we make it through the podcast without a loss of power.
Yeah, it seems like Atlanta is the home of the apocalypse. You got interstate highways burning to the ground. You got forest fires to your north. You've got severe rain. What gives down there?
Hey, man, it's the epicenter of life, right? It is what it is. You know, we just take it as it comes and we just keep on going, Paul.
Yep. And yeah, of course we had a technology problem at the beginning of the show, but I was glad to hear our little jingle. I was hoping that you and I weren't going to have to jump in and do a little rap ourselves.
No, now that would get to a place where we'd really be testing our audience, Paul. Not advisable.
Tell us what we got going on in front of the house today.
Hey, just a couple of things that caught my eye that I'll share with the audience today, Paul. You know, the meter is running this week on what the Democrats may or may not do regarding Judge Gorsuch, but the IFA has made their choice clear, and they've submitted a letter to the Senate in support of the Gorsuch nomination. Speaking for all of us at the IFA, we hope that common sense may prevail, and you know, there's a couple days left to the week. Maybe the Dems will come around on this one. I wanted to call attention, too, to Franchise Capital Access in 2017. What you need to know can be found in a blog post that was put up on the 30th, just a couple days ago, on the IFA's website, and was co-authored by our good friend Daryl Johnson, CEO at FranData, along with IFA's Elizabeth Taylor, and they analyze trends for capital providers in 2017. It's a good read. You can find it at franchise.org, and don't want to miss that. Paul, also something that caught my eye this week that I think is really worthy of attention because of the amount of time you and I spend talking about next gen and youth in franchising. I saw a scholarship that was posted all over the Smart Briefs this week, IFAs, as well as the National Restaurant Associations, and this is just the epitome of anything I've seen done by any companies that are trying to do well by doing good and attract youth to their franchise business models. So my hat goes off to Taco Bell this week for a program that they've put together, and the Taco Bell program is called Live Más. And the Live Más Scholarship Program is to promote college student recipients, not ad agencies, who are going to produce and have done 2 30-second spots that are now airing on national TV. It's part of the Feed a Dream campaign, and it aligns with the 5th anniversary of Taco Bell's most popular menu from the Doritos Local Tacos, and it advertises a feel-good promotion. Taco Bell has given this scholarship fund up to, they will pledge up to $500,000 into the fund by donating 10 cents off of its Live Más scholarship meals. And so these students, who, by the way, unlike a typical scholarship, these students didn't have to have a particular GPA or some type of extracurricular stipulation to be qualified for the scholarship. No, this scholarship is all about passion. So what these students had to do was submit a 2-minute video in which they discussed their life's passion. And from all of those submitted, the students who got to produce this commercial received the scholarship award. Can be seen if you go to TacoBell.com, or you can find more about this in the IFA Smart Brief. Hats off to Taco Bell, though. They're not only walking the talk. The students produced the commercial. The students are funded on a scholarship that doesn't take, you know, a perfect grade point average to attain or to be qualified for, but just something that comes from the heart. And I love that, and I love what Taco Bell is doing. And that pretty much covers the front of the house. Paul, we'll come back a little bit later on the back end and talk about some upcoming events and things that are on the horizon. But I'll throw it back to you for now.
Yeah, some interesting news. First thing I wanted to say was a shout-out to Carmelo Masala and John Evans, both Canadian millennial entrepreneurs in the franchise space. I saw there was an interesting panel discussion with them spearheading it up at the Canadian Franchise Association conference that just ended this week. Really two bright guys in franchising. Really excited to hear about their U.S. plans. Also another shout out to Catherine Monson, who was the keynote this week at the Canadian Franchise Association. It seems like Catherine is everywhere, and as she should be, great message to share with people. Also, yesterday in the newsstand, you know, there was kind of a rumor about Panera Bread being purchased by Starbucks. And yet today was an announcement just a few minutes ago that Panera Bread is being acquired by JAB Holding in a deal valued at $7.5 billion. And, of course, JAB is also the owner of Caribou Coffee and Pete's Coffee and Tea Brands. So, again, another shakeup in the franchise space. And you just wonder if some of the, I'll just refer to them as people on Capitol Hill, would really take a close look at franchising and realize how much we bring to the economy. A $7.5 billion deal. Upcoming.
No small potatoes, Paul. Those are big numbers. That's
not
real money.
Yeah, real money. We have some interesting shows coming up, and I want to talk about the guests coming up. Next week we have Larry Sutton, who's the CEO and founder of R&R Tire. Now, you might think that, you know, who is this? What brand is this? It's a $100 million brand. Larry, it's a franchise brand. And Larry was featured on CNBC's Blue Collar Millionaire, so I'm really looking forward to that. Then 2 weeks after that, we talk about franchise finance with none other than David Nielsen, the CEO and co-founder of Guidant Financial. It should be an interesting show. And, of course, sandwiched in between, very much the segue to sandwich in between, is Jimmy John himself, which will be our guest on April 19th. And, of course, talk about big money deal. If you haven't seen the issue, this month's issue of Franchise Times, read it. Unbelievable deal that Jimmy John has with a private equity firm. So really some exciting shows coming up. And, of course, leading into today's exciting show, Carving Out a Niche in Franchising. Quote by David Adir, the co-founder and CEO of The Carvingwood, said, "We created a concept that isn't your typical sandwich shop. We're constantly innovating, creating a sandwich of the week, appealing to consumers seeking an elevating experience, an elevated dining experience." And that, of course, was by David, our guest today. David, welcome to Franchise Today.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Living the
We're
dream.
Doing fine. Yep, living the dream. And again, Stan, a lot of our guests just don't, they just keep referring to us as gentlemen, so I guess they don't know us. But anyway, that being said, David, read a lot of good things about your brand, seen some stuff on the Food Network, anxious to talk about that. But before we do, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and your co-founder and where this all started out. Take us way back as far as you want. Bring us up to the point that the carving board became a reality, and then later on in the show we'll talk about the franchise component.
Absolutely. Started off I want to say about 13 years old, working as a dishwasher prep cook in a Kenny Rogers Roasters, if any of you remember that. There was a chicken concept. Probably some of the best chicken I've had, but too bad they're all gone. And worked my way through restaurants in high school and kind of continued in college, just like most college people do, and realized that I enjoyed working in restaurants. I enjoyed hospitality. Was going to school and was waiting tables on the side, and decided that a doctor was not the route that I wanted to take, and stuck with restaurants. Ended up becoming a manager for Cheesecake Factory. Spent 7 years with Cheesecake Factory, kind of traveling, opening stores with them, and just kind of learning the business really from the inside out. I definitely say I couldn't have paid for a better education. It's a great brand. I learned a ton. Left after 7 years. I was exhausted, you know, working those 80-hour weeks sometimes, especially during the openings. And from there, I took some time off, kind of relaxed. I ended up working with Chart House for about a year, left them, and just really kind of figured out what I wanted to do. I wasn't sure if I wanted to stay in the restaurant business, so I kind of started exploring other stuff, real estate, looking at other options. And after a couple of years, I realized I missed the restaurant industry tremendously. I missed the fast pace. I missed the people. I missed the atmosphere. It was just something that was kind of ingrained in me, just because I work so much in it, and it's really a industry that is unlike any other. So my brother and I were living together, and we started talking about just tossing the idea around of opening up our own concept. And we looked at kind of what we wanted to do. We were thinking about doing a full-service restaurant. We looked at doing a fine dining restaurant. Unfortunately, this was right around the time that the recession in the States was going on. And we really started to look at the market of how much of a decline there was in a lot of the casual restaurants, the upscale casual restaurants, and even the fine dining restaurants. And when we looked at the segment around that $10 price point, we realized that they were still doing pretty well, that the majority of them hadn't decreased in sales tremendously. Some of them were even up in sales. So we took that idea and said, you know what, okay, this is the price point we really need to be at. What can we develop around this price point? And immediately we both said sandwiches. There was a massive gap in the market for the kind of sandwiches that he and I like to make at home. The first thing on the menu, the first thing we did is the Thanksgiving sandwich, which is the turkey dinner. It is the sandwich that I make every single day for about a week after Thanksgiving. After we have that huge turkey, I slice up, you know, fresh slices of the turkey, put stuffing, I throw gravy on it, onions, cranberries, you know, and some big pieces of sourdough. And it's hands down my favorite sandwich. And I said, okay, this has to go on the menu. And then my brother and I just really started developing what other foods should we put on the menu, what other sandwiches should we put on the menu. And I just kind of sat there and started writing stuff that we enjoyed eating and we enjoyed – sorry. Started that we enjoyed eating and we enjoyed cooking. And the menu was just starting to develop from there. From that, we started looking for real estate, and we were looking for a couple properties that had some criteria. We wanted parking. We wanted to be on a main street. But we were looking for a location that we could still afford, that if we absolutely fell on our face, I could go work as a manager, GM somewhere, and still afford the rent. So from there,
How did you guys wind up becoming bi-coastal? I mean, you grew up in Miami, and the Carving Board is based in California. And what was the driving force to go west?
I had never been in California before. I was actually working at Cheesecake Factory as a waiter and an expediter. And my brother and I got bored one day, turned to each other and said, do you want to move? So we ended up hopping in the car. I called my boss. I said, hey, listen, I'd love to transfer. They transferred me to a location out in Brentwood, and we just drove to California. There was no real driving force. We just had never been here before, and we're looking for something different. And literally hopped in the car and drove here. Stopped along, you know, some of the sites along the way, and pulled into California, pulled into L.A., checked into the nearest motel closest to the restaurant, and started working the next day.
I mean, from my point of view, California is probably one of the toughest places in the world for franchisors, restaurants, just the amount of regulation. For you to be able to take and build and grow a concept in California makes you twice as strong as the second most strong person I might know.
Thank you. Yeah, California's been difficult. I've been here for, I want to say, 12 years now, 13 years now. And, you know, there's tons of regulations. You know, wages are going up. But, you know, you always have to just kind of reinvent what it is that you're doing. And that's what we're doing on a constant basis for everything that we do. It's not just with the regulations.
So you and I were joking around a little bit before we went live on the podcast. And, you know, being from Miami and yourself, and I spent a few years down there, you know, my vision for sandwiches in Miami were Wolfie Cone's, Rascal House, or Pumpernick's. And you guys are nothing like that at all. Let's talk about the edge and the consumer experience. What does a customer walk into when they step in across the threshold and walk into the carving board?
The first thing they do is they walk in and they see the decor. We have a very warm and comforting decor. There's a lot of woods, typical to kind of what's popular now. We use a lot of reclaimed wood. The tables are reclaimed. We have comfortable chairs. And you just see an inviting smile because we are fast casual. So the first thing you do is you walk up and you're directed directly to the counter. You're looking at the menu, and like you said, the sandwiches are not your traditional East Coast, you know, mile high sandwiches. We took ideas that we like that you normally see on a plate and put them in a sandwich. So stuff like fish and chips, spaghetti meatball, turkey dinner, steak. So we have a Bentley, which is a filet mignon with bacon, mayonnaise, blue cheese, spinach, and grilled onions. And that's my version of a bacon-wrapped filet mignon. It's stuff that you normally wouldn't see in a sandwich, and that is really what is setting us apart.
Very interesting.
There.
You know, a lot of things going on, obviously, in California in the food space. Tell us a little bit about how you got picked up by the TV Food Network. I saw an interesting segment on that about your famous spaghetti and meatball witch.
Well, before we were on Food Network, we were on Travel Channel. We had been open about 2 months, and we had a gentleman that came in the restaurant, and he ordered our special of the week, which was the pot roast, traditional pot roast topped with mashed potatoes with corn and Parmesan crust. It's amazing. It's a knife and fork sandwich. It's spectacular. And the gentleman ate the sandwich, turned to my brother and I and said, this is the best bleeping sandwich I've ever had in my entire life. How'd you like to be on TV? And
wow.
You know, at that point he said, how'd you like to be on TV? It was insane. And we said, sure, you know, no problem. Kind of brushed him off. He handed us his business card and said, if you're ever interested, call me. We immediately ran in the back and started Googling him and realized he was legitimate. Went back out there and said, we'd love to. And he said, when can I film? We said, whenever you want. And he said, how's tomorrow? So they shot for Travel Channel the next day. We were on TV in January. So we'd been open about 5 months, 6 months. And the TV show aired and it just kind of exploded from there. And from that, people saw us and we got a ton of exposure. One of the, we've now been on Food Network, or we will be twice. They just shot a second time. The first time I was created this spaghetti meatball sandwich with my brother. It's the bread itself. It's not traditional bread. It's actually bread made out of spaghetti with house-made meatballs, house-made marinara sauce. And we were getting a ton of traction with it. And the Food Network ended up seeing it on either a blog or some kind of write-up, and they said, we have to shoot this. contacted us and just immediately came out and shot a segment.
This is like, you can't make this up, right? This is like a storybook. This is almost amazing that you could have these kinds of people just dropping into your lap. Was there any culinary experience other than your own passion for the kitchen as kids growing up? Did either of you or your brother have any professional training?
We went, not necessarily professional training. I worked in a kitchen for a couple of years as I was working my way through the restaurants. I spent, I want to say, 3 or 4 years in a kitchen, but no true formal culinary experience. It's really just a passion for what we do.
That's just absolutely phenomenal. And I mean, I know you talked about working at the Cheesecake Factory, but I don't think that the kind of attention that's been drawn to the brand would have been something you might have gleaned from the kitchen there. I mean, I could be wrong, but it sounds like you guys have made some magic. So tell us more about the experience. It's clearly the food is the main event, but tell us more about the consumer side of the experience and how a consumer finds you and what kind of marketing you do to attract that kind of profile. And who is the typical consumer? What's the profile of your customer?
So the consumer really kind of finds us. It started off with Yelp. You know, we had 5 stars on Yelp and people were just yelping and looking around. I have to say that social media has really been our main driver. We haven't taken any traditional marketing sense, marketing tactics at all. We've really just stuck to Instagram. We've stuck to Twitter. We've stuck to Facebook. And it's been a ton of word of mouth. Our typical consumer is somebody that's looking for that elevated experience. They're looking for better food. They don't mind spending a little bit more. I want to say that 18 to 35, 18 to 40 range. We get a lot of younger parents that come in with their kids, especially on the weekends. You know, you'll see mom and dad there, and they'll, you know, have a 1 or 2 year old baby, and they're eating sandwiches and just kind of enjoying the day. And then the dinner crowd is actually pretty decent as well, because we've really gone out to change the idea of eating sandwiches for dinner. So the typical person not only comes in for lunch, but they're coming in for dinner as well. You know, as you said, the menu really is the star, but it's not just the menu. When we built the concept, we took everything that we liked and everything that we hated about working in restaurants over the course of, you know, 20 years, 15 years, and we applied that to our concept. So, you know, whether it was the small nuances that corporate made you say, or, you know, the placement of the table was too high or the chair was too low and it felt uncomfortable. We kind of really looked at all aspects of the restaurant and we realized that all the details matter. It's not just one particular thing that really sets us apart. It's the entire package.
And when I was looking at the website, I kind of noted that, you know, we've got, what, 3 corporate locations currently, in addition to the original location. Each with a bit of a different, more, each had their own menu listed. Are there changes or differences in locations, or do you add certain nuance to the menu at each location?
So here in LA, we initially started off with different menus. We've kind of streamlined it for just the LA market, but as we continue to grow, we are going to localize a couple of sandwiches just for particular regions. So we've recently done a deal in the Middle East, and our first location is going to be in Dubai. And we've put together some flavors that are very popular out there. So dates are traditionally Middle Eastern food, and we're incorporating a date and goat cheese turkey sandwich with arugula on a goldy grain bread. So something that you normally don't get to see, but
sorry,
we're trying
I'm
to localize.
Now, my mouth is watering.
it's a lot of fun. I've been out there a couple of times, and I'm just all I get to do is go out and eat and try to think of ideas to incorporate onto our menu. There's nothing like it. It's awesome.
I got to tell you, you know, I need to be a taster on this. Stan, I'm looking through some of the comments on you know, Yelp, and they're talking about, you know, the Wolfgang, a cold turkey sandwich with goat cheese, basil, spinach, sun-dried tomatoes. I love the names of these different things, the Clydesdale and the Longhorn, you know, the French dip with grilled cheese and tomato soup. I mean, it's just, the, you know, the Bentley. Get this, Stan, a filet mignon sandwich that has blue cheese and spinach on the most delicious sourdough bun. I mean, I'm thinking of, Stan, us growing up in Brooklyn, being 8-year-olds, going to the lunchroom on Monday morning and opening up a pot roast sandwich with mashed potatoes as opposed to that old peanut butter and jelly or cheese sandwich or something. I got to tell you, I mean, and I'm sorry for interrupting, but I started, you know, when you were saying arugula and goat cheese and stuff, I mean, my mouth is just, you know, watering here. I mean, just tremendous stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, the ideal customer, I'm thinking if it's in this market, it's a 270-pound Italian guy sitting here that would probably be there every day. Stan, I
pretty much.
This is a tremendous menu, and I love the names behind it. Now, you before the show, you gave us a little inkling into that about the Reuben, named after the original place where the Reuben was founded. What was the inspiration on some of the other names?
We try to take a look at kind of what the sandwich is and what the sandwich represents. So, you know, the Reuben is a great example. The Reuben was discovered or founded in or created in a hotel called the Blackstone. So once we created a Reuben on our menu, we said, okay, what do we name it? We don't want to name it a Reuben. So we did some work on, you know, where the Reuben came from and realized that this hotel, the Blackstone, was where the Reuben was invented. So it's almost like an homage to them. We've got something that is like a chicken cordon bleu. We have the blue ribbon, which cordon bleu is just translated to English as blue ribbon. And it's what you traditionally see in a chicken cordon bleu. It's chicken, spinach, cheese, ham. And then we put our signature sauce on it in between a Tolera roll. We've got, you know, the Bentley is just kind of an homage to the car. We've got kind of the best meats and the best flavors all combined together to create the best sandwich.
Well, when we come back from our half break, we're going to talk a little bit about how you take all this variety and how you're going to manage all that as you teach others to be franchisees who are going to be stewards of this brand and help you protect this brand and deliver the same kind of experience around the country and around the world as you and your brother have done in California. You're listening to Franchise Today. I'm Stan Friedman along with Paul Segreto talking with David Adir, co-founder and CEO of The Carving Board. Franchise Today is brought to you by the Franchise Foundry, where they've been bringing emerging brands to market for more than 30 years. The Foundry fosters healthy, sustainable growth for their clients, the kind that comes from experience. Franchise Foundry provides both coaching and consulting, a hybrid approach that gives more effective solutions to both the franchisor's corporate team as well as their franchisees. The Franchise Foundry team is rich in practical, hands-on experience and expertise in general business management, operational and change management, digital marketing, and, of course, franchise recruitment and development. Plus, the Foundry team can also assist you with creating roadmaps for potential mergers and acquisitions. Learn more about Paul Segreto and the Franchise Foundry, along with their expanding list of clients, at www.franchisefoundry.com. Franchise Today is also brought to you by FRM Solutions, offering best-in-class CRM and document management software designed specifically for franchising. FRM empowers real-time business intelligence, communication, and collaboration between all members of franchisor's team and prospective as well as existing franchisees. This enables you to simply and seamlessly track, access, and manage all messages to and from prospects and existing franchisees, including text messaging. Legal and compliance is simplified too, with FRM's document management, and even site visits can be digitally facilitated and scored with FRM. Make today the day you give FRM a look and assure yourself that all of your candidate and franchisee correspondence, including texts, are being permanently tracked and stored in candidate and franchisee records. No long-term contracts, multiple upgrades each year at no additional cost, no excuses, just solutions, on the web at frmsolutions.com. So, David, let's kind of move into the franchise side of this business as you and your brother are getting ready to not only franchise the country, but putting the stake down and putting a flag down internationally as your first unit. That's a little bit of courage. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, that is. It kind of goes a little bit against the grain. And, I mean, that's got to be a long way from Southern California to Dubai. I don't even know if there's a direct flight. I guess there is these days. So that is interesting. And I think it'd be good to learn about how that came about as the first location, because that's far from a typical strategy.
So we initially weren't really looking at the franchise route. We were just kind of going to grow the concept and get as big as we can on our own. Similar story to the first time we were on television with the Travel Channel. Somebody ate at the restaurant, said, again, this is an amazing concept. Ended up calling, we have a corporate office number, ended up getting to me, and essentially called me one night and said, I would love to bring you to Dubai. I ate at the restaurant a couple of times, and I'm really impressed with what you do. Are you interested in franchising Dubai? Absolutely thought it was a fake phone call. Ran into my brother's room, said, hey, some guy in Dubai wants to franchise us. He's like, yeah, okay. Turns out a couple months down the line, we're going back and forth. The guy's legitimate. The guy has the experience. He has the backing, and we start negotiating a deal. A couple more months go by. We pen it out, sign a contract. We do a development deal where he's opening 15 stores in the Middle East over the next couple of years. And it was a big leap from California to Dubai, but it was a challenge that we were willing to accept because I know it is what we do. We operate restaurants, and duplicating what we do here in the States is no different, you know, opening up in Beverly Hills or opening up in Miami or opening up in Dubai.
So Dubai is on the map. And now you're looking at opening a few more corporate locations, isn't that correct?
Yep. Well, we, you know, again, this is my passion, and this is what I enjoy doing. So we want to continue to own restaurants. We want to continue to expand in the corporate realm as well as the franchise realm. Once that Dubai deal was done, I really started to dig into franchising and really what it's about and, you know, what could be done with franchising and the benefits of it. We decided that we were going to start franchising in the U.S. as well as internationally. We've got 4 stores opening up this year in Dubai, and then we've got some more growth growing. We have something coming up in Qatar, as well as other countries are kind of in the pipeline.
Wow, so you're going to go simultaneous with domestic and international growth. Great. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what the location looks like from a franchise, you know, standpoint, kind of what your ideal prototype is going to be moving forward. You know, help us visualize walking through the door and what a customer will see in a franchise location.
The stores are about 2,000 square feet. We go as big as 2,500. The smaller ones are about 1,800. We have an immediate center area, kind of a focal point. We have 2 separate focal points. The first focal point is going to be the cashier area. It's going to be a counter that's going to be enwrapped in reclaimed wood, and then all the counters are going to be stainless steel. You immediately, it's eye-catching, it's welcoming, it's warm, and that's the first thing that you notice. The second thing that we're doing in the restaurant is we're going to have one wall that's going to have a unique art piece that we're going to find somebody locally that's going to be commissioned to do that art piece. So if you go into any of the 4 stores, we have a different art project on all of our walls. You know, one of them is basically a gas pipe with Edison bulbs. It's amazing. I've got another piece that we commissioned some guy in Venice Beach that we saw his art and said, wow, this is amazing. Can you build something for us? It's made out of old jeans and mixtapes and just all kinds of reclaimed leftovers, so to speak. So those are the two focal points. And then really it's really clean and it's really, you know, it's straightforward. We're playing on the wood and we're playing on that metal finishes so that the floors are all kind of gray. It's a tile, a gray tile with kind of like a cement look. And then our walkways are all made out of tile-like wood or a wood-like tile, sorry. And everything just kind of really flows to that counter and flows to that kitchen area with a massive open kitchen. We want you to see what we're doing. You know, we're very proud of what we're doing. We're very proud of how we keep our kitchen so you can see everything that's going on back there.
With all the moving parts that exist with a menu that's as diverse as yours is, let's talk a little bit about the training and support aspect of your business and how you're going to manage the franchisees and protect the brand in terms of how that experience is delivered. Even locally and domestically, that seems to me to be a bit of a challenge, much less as far afield as Dubai. So tell us a little bit about the training and support and what that will look like for your franchisees.
So franchisees are going to come out, and I think it's a 3 to 4 week training process. I can't remember off the top of my head. I apologize. And they're going to come out, and they're going to work side by side with our team. I've brought in some industry veterans that I've worked with for years. It's great that I've been living in California. I was able to tap friends of mine that I have been working with forever. I know their qualifications. So I've got two people on my corporate team, and then we are going to pull people out of our day-to-day operations. So we've overstaffed our restaurants, and we're pulling the best of the best out of our locations to start with the support, with the training. And the other piece is that we've built everything to replicate what it is we do. One of the sayings that we have in the restaurant is, you know, let's make it dummy proof. So every system, every aspect is really meant to be so that anybody can understand it, whether it's a recipe, whether it's a policy procedure. There's nothing really erroneous on there or nothing that's pointless. Everything has a point, and everything is there for a purpose, and it's very easy to replicate. The menu might look crazy and diverse, but most of the meats are reused in a bunch of the different sandwiches. The breads are all reused. There's not much on that menu that is really hard to make. It's all pretty simple. We did it on purpose.
So I guess that answer it kind of starts to answer what would have been my follow-up question about the ideal candidate. As I noted from your website, with a restaurant that's got so much of it built around food, you're looking for candidates that don't necessarily bring food experience. Tell us about that, David.
We are looking for candidates. Our ideal candidate would be somebody that does have food experience, somebody that knows how to run a kitchen, somebody that knows how to manage food costs, because we work 90% food, 10% front of the house. You know, what we've really found out over the years is that if everything is right, there's really no need for, you know, that typical manager walking around and, you know, shaking hands and doing 1,000 table visits. We never get food sent back. You know, our comp line is really, really low just because the food comes out right. It comes out on time and the food's great. And if you're giving great service and great food, you know, everything's relatively easy to run up front. So we are definitely looking for somebody that does have kitchen experience, but if we have a qualified candidate that comes around, it's not something that we can't teach. And that's really the best thing, is that we've built it so that it can be replicated. You know, all the recipes, as I said, are simple. I mean, there's nothing tremendously complicated in what we do.
So it seems like there's going to be, you know, some challenges, at least issues to be addressed with respect to a slight supply chain, especially as you are built around, you know, fresh ingredients. And so I imagine, you know, systems are being put in place, and that will continue through, and I'm sure that's going to be an integral component towards the success of the brand. And I guess my question, kind of just piggybacking, you know, stands, I look and having spent some time in the back of the house in restaurants, I think about the prep time, especially since you're using all, you know, fresh ingredients and stuff. So keep that in mind, but kind of bring us through what you project to be the day in the life of a franchisee, you know, starting with, you know, that very, very important beginning of the day when a lot of the prep actually occurs.
So a day in the life of the franchisee would really be kind of depending on what type of franchisee. If it's somebody that's multi-unit that's not going to work in the restaurant and they've got, you know, the support staff that's going to do it for them, that's absolutely fine. But if it's going to be an owner-operator, they're really going to get in there and kind of get their hands dirty and just kind of work side by side with their staff. You know, we come in, we're in about 8:30 in the morning every day, and we're prepping just like a traditional restaurant would. We're making our sauces, we're roasting our meats, we're baking breads. You know, we're really setting up for the day. During that time, you know, they would go in there and create all their prep calls. They would kind of manage the prep, just make sure all the pars are done correctly, being anything, under prepping anything. And then from there, they're just really setting production for the rest of the day and kind of setting the plan for the rest of the day of what we're going to do and what we're going to sell, whether it's going to be, you know, do we have X amount of catering orders in the morning? And then really just kind of going to the lunch shift and, you know, having the lunch shift be as productive as possible, really making sure that the food is coming out the way it needs to come out, and the way it looks, it's supposed to look. You know, we're always tasting things. In the mornings, we do a full taste, a full line check, where we're tasting all of our products and making sure that everything has the flavor profile that we're looking for, as well as the consistency that we're looking for. And then from there, it jumps right into the night shift where you're still, again, taking a look at your prep pars. It's, you know, it's to me, it's what I grew up doing in the restaurant industry. It's I just took all of the ideals that we were trained with and kind of applied them to what we do today. You know, we're not sending over a ton of packaged goods. Everything's not ready to go, and you're just cutting open a bag and putting it on bread. We're making, sure, we're cooking, sure, we're prepping. There is a lot of moving parts, but the quality is night and day when you really take a look at the finished product.
Kind of reminds me, Stan, of some of the old Northeast diners that had so much on the menu, except in this case, you know, we're turning it into, you know, the comfort food sandwich. David, tell us a bit about, you gave us a nice walkthrough and allowed us to visualize the location. Tell us what you're going to be looking for in the way of site selection. What type of neighborhoods, what type of traffic, something along those lines. We kind of visualize a little bit more of what the real estate is going to look like and what part of town you're looking to be in, because obviously we don't see this on every corner, so to speak, but certainly some of the hot spots in town.
Yeah, and that's really kind of what we are right now, is we definitely don't think that we're going to be on every corner. We don't want to be on every corner. We've actually turned down a lot of locations, potential franchisees that we're trying to open in markets that I knew weren't going to succeed for us right away. We're really looking for those densely populated areas. We're looking for demographics that have a good amount of people. We're looking for the above average household income. We're definitely a higher end brand, and we can't just be put in the middle of nowhere and expect to do the sales that we're doing here in Los Angeles. So we're really looking for the major metropolitan cities. We're looking for those up and coming cities that are, you know, the word foodies thrown around. You know, you hear things about Austin and Miami and you know, that everybody's an up and coming foodie city. And those are the cities that we're really looking to start penetrating in.
Yeah, it looks like, based upon the additional cities for Target expansion, including, Austin, Dallas, Chicago, Miami, New York, San Francisco, and Seattle, certainly there's a level of sophistication. But also, and I guess the million-dollar question, to use four of the same first letters, is this going to be geared more towards millennials as a consumer? And if that's the case, do you see more millennials coming in as potential franchise operators, or do you think it transcends across different generations?
I definitely think the majority of our clientele or our customer base is our millennials. They understand what we're doing. I'm not too far off out of that age range, just a couple of years. And, I definitely have the same thought process as they do on a lot of things. And we are attracting more millennial franchisees than I expected. And then we also have the traditional franchisee profile that have owned, a ton of restaurants, and they see the concept and they see the potential in the concept as well. So it's a little bit of both to answer your question. I think we definitely are gearing towards millennials, but I think we have the ability to transcend just because we're such a unique concept. We didn't reinvent the wheel and just, toast it or we didn't just take the sandwich and
sure,
add one item to it and just make it a little bit different. No offense to those guys out there, but, we took the sandwich and we just completely changed what it is to be a sandwich.
Yeah, it's an interesting twist.
I see this concept in destination markets like Vegas or Orlando, places where you're driving through a tremendous amount of tourism and they get a taste and a flavor and they look at this and go, wow, I got to bring this back home. I'm going to open this.
Yeah.
And, you could probably pick up with the kind of sizzle that your brand, in my mind's eye, represents, those destination markets where people get exposed to the brand could probably become the greatest pipeline builder for development. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I think that has a lot of substance behind it. I think that's in part a good strategy. What I find interesting with this is the traditional, which of course is some of these traditional meals like pot roast and mashed potatoes on bread, and of course we have millennials that are not so much traditional. We also have, obviously substantial investment in opening up an opportunity. I think it's a great opportunity for multi-generational partnerships, which, of course, is really big in California when you look at multi-generational homes that are going up. Partnering up some of the baby boomers that have a little bit of wealth with some of the millennials that have a lot of the new ideas and work power and stuff like that, partnering together. I love the concept. I can't wait to try the product because in my mind, I've just got this. I'd have, quite frankly, a hard time choosing, the one that I would want to start off with. I think it might be the Bentley, but
that's probably the biggest issue that we have is people come in and they're almost overwhelmed by the menu. And the Bentley is usually the first sandwich that we push them to just because it is, first of all, it's my bestseller. Second of all, it is spectacular. I'll eat it once a month and I always forget how great the sandwich is. When you're eating it on food and you go, holy crap, this is amazing.
To me, it's exactly the point you bring out. It can be overwhelming. Stan and I have a propensity wherever we are together, we try to seek out, a Jewish deli. When we're in New York, it's Katz's. And because I don't get there often enough, I immediately, navigate the menu all the way to the pastrami on rye, and I get that and maybe add a knish. But if I went there every week, I'd probably, want a corned beef once in a while. I'll probably get a couple of Hebrew National hot dogs once in a while. And I think the same thing would be true here, which is what I like about this concept, is the fact that if they have such a great experience the first time and they see the diversity of the menu, they want to come back, another week and try it. It's like I'm looking at this this, you know, spaghetti and meatball, which, I mean, how did that come about? Because obviously there's nothing traditional about that type of traditional dish made into a sandwich.
That one is super unique. It's one of my favorite comfort foods. You know, as I said, we're a comfort food sandwich spot. And spaghetti meatballs is literally my go-to comfort food. Is, you know, I'm in a bad mood, I'll make myself a, you know, homemade pasta or and some meatballs, and I'll just sit there and just be in heaven. We had to really figure a way to turn that into a sandwich. It was something I'm like, listen, this is my comfort food. We need to figure this out, you know, my brother and I. And we went through just variation after variation from putting pasta into meatballs. So we were kind of stuffing meatballs with pasta to kind of pushing pasta into bread. So it, you know, still had pasta in it. So we would make garlic bread and just kind of shove pasta in it. Like I said, we went through variation after variation. And then one of us just said, hey, what if the pasta was the bread? And from that, we again went through 20 or 30 variations of turning spaghetti into a holdable, moldable bread. So you can actually pick the sandwich up and it holds together. It doesn't fall apart. And that was just, I want to say it took us about 2 years to really get it right. But when we did get it right, it's just been a home run for us.
Wow.
I wanted to ask you before we run out of time, David, because you kind of touched on something that I want to circle back on in terms of the profile of a franchisee. You guys are obviously looking at area development and international growth as well as individual franchise unit operators. What's the sweet spot, though? Who are you actually trying to attract, and what would your target be?
We're really looking. I mean, our ideal customer, our ideal franchisee is going to be somebody that already has multi-unit. It's going to be a multi-unit operator. We're really looking for area development, somebody that is looking to fold us into their portfolio, you know, that's already operating at a high volume, already operating a restaurant, and is really just looking to kind of expand because their market has already been saturated with the brands that they already have. And they're really looking for something new and different that's going to bring something fresh to their portfolio and to their area.
So as we get close to the finish line, the multi-unit franchising show coming up in Las Vegas later this month, are you guys participating there? And if so, or if not, why not help the audience with some information about where they may be able to find more information or actually see you guys someplace on the trail and tell us how they can be able to easily contact you for more information?
So our franchise website is franchisetheboard.com. Our restaurant website is eattheboard.com. So we're all about the board. We are not going to be at the multi-unit franchising conference. We've got a bunch of stuff going on here in the States that we're unfortunately unable to attend. But we will be at the New York franchising show, the IFA show in New York. We're basically coming out to California and really trying the food is the best way to really figure out what we are. You know, our sales process is not tremendously difficult. The first thing we want you to do is try the food, because once you try the food, you're going to be hooked immediately. And that's really what our selling point is come in, try the food, see what the concept is, you know, see with your own eyes. And, as we continue to grow and as we continue to hit up these shows, we're going to look at really just kind of sampling the food, because that is what sells us. Our food is our star.
So one more time,
great.
The URL is franchisetheboard.com for
yes,
franchising and for the consumer
the
side.
The board. Yes, franchisetheboard.com, or you can go to eattheboard.com, and it'll link you over to the franchise website. Or you can just Google the Carving Board franchise. We'll be the first one that comes up.
David, we want to thank you tremendously for whetting our appetites today and inducing us to go out and buy a round-trip ticket and come see in California, or maybe even sooner than the IFE in New York. Thank you so much for appearing with
thank
us today on Franchise
me.
Today.
I appreciate it. Thank you,
thank
gentlemen.
Thank you, David.
All right.
Well, Stan,
we'll see you in
I can't
soon.
Say that I'm I can't say that I'm getting off the air without being hungry. I definitely am. There's no two ways about that.
Well, the shameful thing for me is I already ate my lunch and I'm still hungry after listening to all this.
Well,
Paul,
we
got some stuff rapidly approaching. Next up on the agenda is the multi-unit conference, April 23rd through the 26th, coming up in Vegas. The FA Legal Symposium is right on the heels of that, May 7th through 9th in Washington, D.C., and followed by the IFA-IBA Joint Conference, which extends out to the 10th. The International Franchise Expo, which David just talked about, right behind that, June 15 through 17, and then even through the summer, Franchise Capital Exchange coming up before you know it. It sounds like it's far out there now, August 22 to 24 in Chicago, but really, that's just around the corner. And before you know it, we're back in D.C. For the Fall Action Network annual meeting, 9/11 and 9/13. So lots on the menu between now and the fall, my friend. Things are moving at a pretty good clip, including the thunderstorms. Don't know if you're hearing any of it behind me or not. I hope not. But made it through
the
hour. There's the good news.
The way you were running through the calendar, I was ready to go in the attic and pull the Christmas tree down. Damn, this year is going by fast. All right, next week we got Larry Sutton, R&R Tire, who's a guest on, he was on the CNBC show, The Blue Collar Millionaire. That's next week, followed by the infamous Jimmy John the week after. Really looking forward to that as well. Until next week, my name is Paul Segreto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great, great thing we call franchising. And Franchise Today is out.
Franchise Pros, Stan the Man, Paul Segreto, Badlands, baby. Franchising Today, sustainable growth, the sensible franchising. Franchise Today, sustainable growth, the sensible franchising. Franchise Today, Franchising Today. Franchising Today.